Hello and welcome to Wednesday, October 8th edition of Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. Thank you for sharing your day with us. We'll be chatting with Doug Vandergraft, who's in town to sign copies of his new book, A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska. Then we'll talk about youth hockey season. It starts soon. We'll get the music of Mark Chestnut, who's in town next Monday for a concert to benefit the Fraternal Order of Alaska State Troopers. And then Fire Chief Ed Quintal will be here to highlight Saturday's candlelight vigil. All that and more. Stay tuned. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Fatal police shootings across the country have made headlines, and communities are voicing concerns over police use of force, especially on people of color. A group in Minneapolis is working to change the way people respond to situations. It's called Indigenizing Crisis Intervention. Reporter Melissa Townsend attended one of the training sessions and has this report.
There are about 40 people here for this training, including Rachel Enright. She works with at-risk youth in Minneapolis Public Schools.
I haven't received a lot of training about mental health with youth, and so I'm just excited to learn the appropriate ways to respond in kind of a crisis situation.
In this training, actors play the role of someone in crisis, and a volunteer from the group responds.
Whoa, don't come in my apartment.
Oh, I'm not in your house. I'm just trying to see what's going on here.
You don't know what's going on, so don't try to bug me. Who even talked to you? Who sent you down here?
Facilitator Lemoyne Lapointe says first responders often enter this situation and try and take control to stop the behavior. He says indigenizing your response means you show compassion and want cooperation rather than aggression and control.
Lakota means an alliance of friends. We say that healing cannot take place alone. If we're to isolate somebody who needs help, then we're only increasing the likelihood of that person getting sicker.
Toward the end of the training, Rachel Enright seems to have gotten the message.
Something that really stuck with me is the importance of listening so that the student has a better sense of calm and control over themselves before you start figuring everything out.
Lemoyne Lapointe works with the Barbara Schneider Foundation to host these trainings around the country. For National Native News, I'm Melissa Townsend.
Some Lakota people are calling for a name change of a peak in the Black Hills. They say Harney Peak is offensive to Native Americans. As Jim Kent reports, it's named after General William S. Harney.
The dedication came as a result of Harney's actions in the 1855 Battle of Ash Hollow in Nebraska, where more than 80 Lakota men, women, and children were killed. Basil Braveheart is a Lakota elder and Korean War veteran. He's pushing to have the name of Harney Peak changed in light of the general's behavior in combat.
The values seem to represent that it's okay to name a peak in the sacred Black Hills after a man who committed a crime against humanity. Also, what really bothers me, too, is this rules of military engagement.
Braveheart notes that while serving in Korea, he and his fellow soldiers fought to preserve the Constitution. He adds that honoring Harney's actions is a reflection of the country's values toward human decency. Braveheart is suggesting the name be changed to Black Elk Peak. Myron Puyer, a descendant of the legendary Lakota spiritual leader Black Elk, agrees and notes that efforts to change the name are being conducted in a peaceful way. The Black Elk family has received a letter of support from the family of William Harney regarding changing the name of the peak designated for their ancestor. The procedure for making the change would require applying to the state's Board on Geographic Names. If approved, the request would then be sent to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names for a final decision. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A herd of bison is headed to the Cherokee Nation. 40 buffalo are being transferred from the Badlands to Oklahoma. It's been 4 decades since the tribe last raised the animals. A herd is expected this week from South Dakota, and another herd will be delivered this month from North Dakota. The Intertribal Buffalo Council awards its member tribes surplus bison from national parks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered. Cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, it's 3.05 p.m. in Alaska, Juneau, Alaska. This is Joan Pardis, your Wednesday host for Juneau Afternoon. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show, and the weather right now is partly cloudy after a glorious morning. Rain likely tonight, rain tomorrow, Thursday night rain heavy at times, lows around 46, and Friday rain right through the weekend. So if you already haven't got out, it's the time to do so. What a glorious fall day. So our first guest is Doug Vandergraft. He is an author. He put together a book called A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska. Epicenter Press published the book, and he is in town right here in Juneau to do some book signings tonight at the Hearthside Books down in the Nugget Mall, sorry about that, from 6 to 7, and tomorrow at the Alaskan Hotel from 5 to 6. So, Doug, welcome to Juneau.
Thank you, Joan. It's my pleasure to be here. I love Juneau.
Okay, so you lived in Alaska from 1983 to 2000.
Correct.
And that's when this idea of a book came to you?
It did. It was probably towards the end of my time in Alaska. I was talking to a friend of mine who had come up from Colorado, and I was telling him all the things I had learned about bars of Alaska. You know, that some bars are operating in the same location with the same name since Prohibition ended in 1933. You know, some bars double as community centers, and some bars even double as churches. And I thought, this is a really interesting subject, and he thought so too. And he says, we should write a book. And as it turns out, I was the one that wrote the book.
Well, how did you find this all out? How did you find out that, oh, some of these bars double as churches or community centers, so on and so forth? Did you have work that brought you out all over the state?
That's a good question, yeah. So I moved to Alaska and to Anchorage in 1983. I was hired by the federal government, Bureau of Land Management, to be a cartographer. And as time went on, I got sent to do field work, and so I got to go to a variety of towns, some towns that, Kodiak and Dutch Harbor, and places that maybe not all other Alaskans get to go to. And when I was 24, so going to a bar was still kind of a novelty to me, and I would go to bars, and I was like, wow, this is a really interesting bar. And as I got older, and I go to the lower 48 states, and I'd go to other bars down there, I started to realize the uniqueness of Alaska bars. You know, like, remember the old birdhouse on Turnagain Arm? Do you remember that bar? No. There was a unique bar right outside of Anchorage, about 40 minutes, that was on a whole slant. That is, when you sat at the bar, you had to hold your beer, otherwise it was going to go sliding down the bar. And the walls were covered with bras and panties and business cards. It was just, and you walk in there, and there was just this certain smell, and I'll never forget. It's called the Birdhouse.
Is it still open?
No, it burned out in 1996. And I had been to, like, there are other salty dog bars in Lower 48, but none has the character or the unique location that Salty Dog does at the end of the Homer Spit. People said, Doug, you're going to Dutch Harbor? You got to go to this bar. It's called the Elbow Room. All the fishermen talk to you. You have to go see it. People, I would come down to the southeast to see friends. They say, Doug, you got to get over to Pelican. There's this bar over there called Rosie's. You would not believe what goes on in there. And so what a thrill it was for me to go to these places, and particularly go to Pelican, and actually interview Rosie Miller. I started putting this stuff together, and I decided to write the book. And in 2000, I got promoted, and I had to move to Washington, D.C. And I'm like, how am I ever going to write this book now? And because of a work assignment, I had to go to the Library of Congress, and I said, look at all the Alaska stuff. And then I went to the National Archives, same thing. Oh, my God, look at the volumes of Alaska material, and a lot about liquor licenses and bars and everything. I'm going, I can actually make this work. And so I started methodically going through the material, and every other year I would come back to Alaska and go to bars I'd never been to before, go talk to historical societies. And in essence, that's what my book is. It's a history book. It gives you an idea of what it's like to go to the bar today, but it's a history book.
And the research must have been fun.
It was. I realized pretty early on, though, that I couldn't drink and do interviews at the same time. So, you know, literally, a lot of my research comes from my living in D.C., which is where I live right outside of D.C. right now.
Well, it's field research and then real research.
Correct.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:10 p.m. Doug Vandegraaff is our first guest. He's got a book called A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska. He's in town signing his books tonight at the Nugget Mall Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall and the Alaskan Hotel from 5 to 6. So here are some questions. Notorious.
Right.
It's a guide to the notorious bar. So what was the rubric for you to say it was notorious and it deserved to be in this book?
Yeah. Well, the criteria. I kind of came up with the criteria. The bar has to have been in existence for at least 25 years. The bar has to remain in the same city, town, or village. And the bar has to have the same name, or if it changed names, people still call it by the old name. But back to your question about notoriety, I like the word. But along the way, I sort of thought to myself, you know, why are people remembering this bar? Why do people keep talking about it? Why are these bars so unique? And I write about it in the book that most people go to bar to have a good time, and they're listening to music, or they're playing sport, you know, playing games, they're dancing, they're having a good time. But unfortunately, bars can also be the scene of tragedy, you know, even murder in some place. And as time goes on, people start to associate the good times, the bad times, whatever they are, with that particular location. The legends grow, the stories get exaggerated, and over time, I think places become synonymous with the stories and ultimately become notorious.
Okay. And so how many notorious bars of Alaska made it into your book?
135.
Wow. That's a lot of bars.
That's a lot of bars. It's a big state, as you know.
I know. And 8 of those bars are in Juneau, Alaska.
Correct.
Okay. And 17 in Anchorage, that's the grandest number?
That's right. That's the big one. Obviously the city with the most notorious bars.
Okay. And so that was your rubric to make it notorious. So do you think you, with the rubric you just said, 25 years in existence, same name, or people still call it that?
Correct.
You think you caught every bar?
I intentionally left some out. I made a distinction between bars that are primarily bars and bars that are primarily restaurants. Which is, you're not going to see some very popular places like the Hangar here in Juneau. It's primarily a restaurant, you know, or the Peanut Farm in Anchorage, or Ivory Jack's in Fairbanks. Those didn't make the list. So I tried to focus on bars that really are. You can get something to eat, but they're primarily a bar.
Okay. So you're doing a bit of a tour. You were up in Anchorage, and
correct.
Then you were at the Alaska Historical Society?
The Alaska Historical Society had a conference in Seward, and I gave a presentation about the notorious bars of Alaska. I talk about in my presentation the history of alcohol and bars in Alaska. I talk about the most famous bars in Alaska. And then, because I was in Seward, I talked about the notorious bars of Seward. And so it's basically the same presentation if people want to see me do it tonight there at the Nugget Mall.
Okay. So I just have a couple of questions. I don't want you to give away your presentation
The
book is really, I was going to say give away the details of the book, but there's 138 bars. And it goes like a guidebook. It's just the name of the bar. It's the name. It's the address. It's license issued. And then amenities. And then it goes right into the history and notoriety. It's kind of like, you know, a trail book. That, you know, you have the who, what, where, when, and why.
I think that's definitely what I had in mind. My editor said, Doug, this book is too long because I wrote about all the bars that are gone now. I called it Gone Before Notorious, and all the places that people still remember and still talk about. And that's all on my website, notoriousbarsofak.com. My bibliography, also way too long. That's on the website as well.
All right. So can you give us just a little information about the history of alcohol in Alaska?
A little bit of information, yeah. There were a lot of bars, and when I first started doing research for the book, I thought, well, where am I going to start? How am I going to start this? So I started looking at bars that were around during the time of the Klondike Gold Rush. And then I realized that, wait a second, Alaska went dry in 1918. And Prohibition wasn't over until 1933, so I made a conscious decision. I'm going to pick that period of prohibition, that 15 years when this state was bone dry, to say that that reset the clock as to how old a bar can be. Therefore, no bar, by the criteria of my book, no bar can be older than April 7th, 1933, when it was once again legal to sell beer and wine in a bar.
Right. So you're saying it was bone dry legally. Our state was bone dry legally as far as that, because we have no idea what happened in 1918 from 1933. I think there might have been a few people.
There's lots of speakeasies. You bet. Alaskans were never really without alcohol. You know, the proximity of Southeast to Canada, which had no prohibition, and the general apathy towards prohibition by Alaskans, lack of law enforcement, and just a huge amount of towns where there were people doing moonshining. Yeah.
And plus, we Alaskans don't really like doing anything the lower 48 does. I say that tongue-in-cheek, but there is an element of truth. So on the cover is a great black and white cover, black and white picture, and it's from a bar in Douglas, 1908. So that kind of predates what's in the book, which starts 1933. So
correct.
That's a little bit of alcohol. Okay, give us some great juicy story from your book.
A juicy story.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about being at Rosie's Bar in Pelican. And she is a trip. Rosie Miller is a great person to interview.
This is a family show.
She told me that a very hardcore Christian woman came into her bar and held Rosie's hands and said, let's pray now and ask God for forgiveness for all the sins that have taken place in your bar, which they did. Rosie humored her and they did that. And she said right after that was over, the woman bought two t-shirts, which say on the back, take off your pants, let's have a party.
And if you want more information on that, you have to go to his website, because as I said, this is a family-friendly show. So what's the website again?
NotoriousBarsOfAK.com.
Okay, so that sounds great. And so when you're done here in Juneau, and as I said, 8 of our bars are highlighted in this book, Hearthside tonight at the Nugget Mall, 6 to 7, Alaskan Hotel from 5 to 6, which should be very
great,
fun,
tomorrow.
A little happy hour with book signing.
Yep.
Where do you go after this?
I have to go home, actually. I have to go back to the East Coast, but I'm coming back in May, and I'm going to start in Anchorage, go to Fairbanks, go to Nome, and to Kodiak.
Okay, and what are your hopes for this little tour guide?
I'd like to keep it going, because, mm-hmm. you know, there are bars that will be getting to be 25 years old that I'm very conscious of, that people really like, that the second edition, these bars will come on and become part of the book. And unfortunately, we're also going to lose bars, you know, and they'll kind of, that's what has happened. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of really cool places over the years. I hope that the Arctic Bar doesn't close. I was in town, I was walking around last night and realized, oh my God, Arctic Bar doesn't look like it's open. Hoping that changes.
Okay.
That's a neat bar.
All right. We've been chatting with Doug Vandegraft. He's the author of A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska. He's in town to sign some books. And I'm really happy that one of the stories you shared with, it sounds like Southeast is well represented in this
book. It sure is, Joan. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Hey, let's have some music. There's a place on the corner where the gang loves to meet, where the jukebox music makes you pat your feet. In the middle of the evening when the spirits are gay, the fat bartender, you will hear him say, shut up!
Look for me!
And drink your beer. There's a man asleep neath the table in the rear.
Shut up! I'm sorry.
And drink your beer. It's time to have another. Now Patrick Mahoney, he was always the same. He'd lick any man with an Irish name. Patrick, walk in. Now this is the place where the chorus began.
Shut up!
I enjoy anything.
And drank your beer. The man still asleep neat the table in the rear.
Shut up!
Oh, I'm asleep.
And drank your beer. it's time to have another. Noisy, and you know that it will. The folks all around you seem to have their fill. You all know the words from beginning to end. So one, two, three, let's all sing it again.
Shut up! What's the matter?
And drink your beer. The man's still asleep neath the table in the rear.
Shut up! I want to fight.
And drink your beer. It's time to have another.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show, and he picks all the songs. I'm Joan Pardis, your host for Wednesday. And here in the studio, we have our next guest. We're here to talk about youth hockey. We've got Steve Quinn and Arnold Liebert, and it is time to sign up for the youth hockey program. So first of all, before we even get going about registering, what is the youth hockey program like? What's the age range, and what do you offer?
Well, that's a good question. First, thanks for letting us be here. We always like to talk about our youth hockey program in the fall. As the days are getting colder, it's definitely the smell of hockey in the air. Registration has been open, and we've just started our 12th season on the ice, which is really, really unbelievable.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're really proud of that. There are quite a few different groups. When we talk about youth hockey, we talk about the mites and the squirts and the peewees and the bantams and the midgets, and people usually say, what are you talking about? And these are actually age designations, and they're set by USA Hockey internationally. So
you didn't come up with those names yourself?
So we didn't come up with those names ourselves.
Because they're pretty good.
Yeah, they are good, and we do like them. So the mites is the youngest age, and those are ages 5, 6, 7, and 8. And then our squirts are ages 9 and 10, and our peewees are 11 and 12. The bantams are ages 13 and 14. And then the midgets is basically high school age kids, 15, 16, 17, and even including 18-year-olds.
Wow. So I'd be really concerned about what the non-midgets look like, because those guys and gals are pretty big. So
pretty big.
All right. So you have a full range from 5 to 18 programs.
We have
everything. You serve everybody. And then what's the commitment? Is it kind of like a semester of is it once a week?
We sign up for the entire year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if people start in the middle of the year, or people move to town and they want to join into the youth hockey program, we can prorate the cost. But we basically have one registration, which is open continuously, and it's open right now on our JDIA website at jdiahockey.com. So if anybody's still interested in getting out there on the ice, we certainly could use a few more skaters. The one age group that I didn't talk about that Steve's going to hit on here is the introduction to hockey. This is for the youngest of the youngest. So this is age as early as 4 years old, 5 years old. And we do an introduction to hockey class. It's a very affordable class. It starts this Saturday. I think that's October 11th.
Yes.
And the time will be at 10:30. And so it meets every Saturday for 1 hour, 10:30 to 11:30. The price is a screaming deal. We charge $99 for the entire year, which gets you one sheet of ice every Saturday. And it even includes some hockey gear, and Steve can talk about more because he's one of the coaches that helps out about that.
Okay. So that's one of my questions. So mm-hmm. When parents hear hockey, and obviously you're talking to parents, you're talking about kids here, people go, oh, a lot of gear. So what if a family is in a situation that they're interested, but maybe they're thinking, wow, this sport is too expensive for me. Is that true? I mean, like, is there ways to get around to it?
There are. We work really hard to make make our youth hockey not just fun but affordable. And with the introductory program, as Arnold said, it's $99. The first 2 weeks are free. So if after 2 weeks you don't want to continue, mm-hmm. there's no penalty.
That's great.
None at all. Further, we have gear that we can loan the families. And it costs, it's a $100 deposit. And if all the gear is returned at the end of the season, then the $100 is returned.
Oh, that's great.
So essentially the gear then is free.
Right, and I would imagine within the hockey community there's a lot of passing down and swaps and so on and so forth, I would imagine, within the hockey
community. There is, and we try to make these bags complete, and with the some of the newer gear. We've just got new helmets recently, in fact.
Okay, great.
And this group, this is just a fun group to be with on the ice.
The young ones this Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's just it's a blast, and the kids are having fun. They're not afraid to fall, and they just they dive on the ice because they know they can do it without getting hurt. They get back up, and the coaches have a lot of fun as well. And what's really nice about this for the kids, and I hope the parents see this, is we have anywhere from 6 to 8 coaches out there on the ice. So you're talking about a ratio of 4 players to maybe 1 coach. So these kids are getting a lot of attention, and they're getting a lot of play time, and they're having a lot of fun.
That sounds great. That sounds great. So that's this Saturday, and then registration's open. Can you say that website one more time?
Yes, that's JDIA hockey.com.
Okay.
And JDIA is the Juno Douglas Ice Association.
Perfect. Okay. And then so that's coming up. And do you have any other events that are coming up?
Actually, we do have a few events. Every once in a while, we're able to, thanks to the Youth Activity Grant with the City and Borough of Juno, we're able to bring some really internationally well-known high-level camps into Juno, which is much more affordable than having kids go outside and attend these camps. And so this November 4th, 5th, and 6th, we're bringing the Laura Stamm Power Skating Clinic to Juno.
Wow.
And this is really geared towards the 9 to 14-year-old range kids. And she's going to be able to do 2 sessions here, her and she's bringing another trainer down with her. And so they're going to be able to do 2 sessions, a youth session for an hour and a half a night for 3 nights, and they're also going to do an adult session, which is really for the Juno Adult Hockey Association, which is another large user group of the rink.
Huge, playing
they're
10 o'clock, too. 11 o'clock
they,
at night,
they
whenever
play
they
late.
Can.
They do. So the Laura Stamm Power Skating Clinic, we're really looking forward. This is the first time she's coming down here to do a 3-day clinic. She's very much looking forward to this. And she is very well known. In fact, Steve, didn't she
she's worked with a lot of accomplished NHL players, former NHL players. And we even have a photo of Laura with Wayne Gretzky in one of our locker rooms.
That's pretty cool. So this particular class for the 9 to 11-year-olds, is that for kids who already really know how to skate and it's to go? You know, what's the target audience?
So the clinic, it's for actually anybody who likes it, who would want to take it. But we're really targeting the kids that are the Squirts, Pee-wees, and Bantams, which is 9 to 14 years of age. But older kids who are still learning to power skate or skate better, you know, they're more than welcome. But there is some basic assumptions that kids will be able to, you know, they can stand on their feet pretty well. They can do basic crossovers. They can do basic backward skating. There is a basic level where it will be beneficial to the kid. Otherwise, the skater just won't benefit from all the things that are going to be taught in the clinic if they don't have that. The basics.
The basic foundational skills. Is there a number that people could call, or is there an email address if people are listening in to say, hey, you know, I'm interested, but I've got a couple of questions about my particular kid?
Absolutely. They can always call me personally. I'm the coaching director, and I'm the sit on the board of directors for the Juno Douglas Ice Association. And again, my name is Arnold, and I can be called at 321-3505 with any questions regarding the youth hockey program or with the Laura Stamm Power Skating Clinic.
Okay. And how many kids... you don't have to give me an exact count, but generally, how many kids are in your program every year?
This year, we're running just about 160.
Wow.
And it's actually a little low. I mean, we've been running into a little challenge lately, and I don't think it's unique to youth hockey. I think other associations are struggling lately with getting more youth involved, and so we're really trying to get that number up. We've made the registration fee as low as we possibly can. You know, we don't make a profit. We're just trying to stay afloat at this. We're trying to make it as affordable for every family or every player that wants to be out there. We want to make sure they're able to get out there, and the cost is not going to be that much of an issue.
Right. So if you're listening and you have any questions, give them a buzz, because obviously it's a perfect time to get your kid on the ice.
Yeah, this is the perfect time. We just started the program. I think we're 2-3 weeks in it, so we're just starting to settle down into it. But more players, we still get a couple more signing up every week. Which is really good. So, like I said, the registration cost is good all the way through the end of the year, which is pretty much through March, about the middle of March or so. So it's a lot of ice being provided.
That sounds great. So anything besides the Power Skate Clinic, is there something else?
Absolutely. In December, we are going to start an inaugural tournament for the squirt level, which is the 9 and 10-year-olds. And this gives these kids a chance to compete against teams from outside the area. And we're inviting communities like ours, smaller programs, Tok, Healy, Homer, Kenai, and Whitehorse, Haines Junction. We've gone to some of those places for their tournaments, and we'd like for them to come to ours. And the tournament is December 12th, 13th, and 14th.
No, that sounds great. That was one more question. So you have your weekly ice time. I guess that's what it's called, because you're saying it's a lot of ice. So you have your weekly ice time, and then you do have games, or tournaments.
We have games among the players in the program every Saturday. We split them up, and they play against each other. Our first games are this Saturday, in fact.
Great. And then you have tournaments of visiting teams.
We're going to host a tournament in December. Some of our players will travel to Whitehorse and others for a tournament. And then in March is the state tournament. And just about every team that we have will leave Juneau and go to respective state tournaments, except for one. And that's because we're hosting a tournament, and I'll have Arnold talk a little bit about that.
What tournament are we hosting?
So every year is the Alaska State Hockey Association puts on the statewide hockey tournament. And so this is for rec hockey leagues. There's different levels. And this is basically considered the house league, which is levels 3 and 4. And so this year, Juneau, we applied for and we received permission to have the Bantam Level 3 state tournament here in Juneau.
Oh, that's great.
And this is the very first time that we're going to have this level of this particular tournament here.
And when will that be?
And so that is going to be March 13th through the 16th is when it's calendared. It's going to be a little bit dependent on the number of other teams that sign up. But it's not only just good for the community, because having it local, more players can participate. The parents can be there who may not have otherwise been able to travel. But it's a really boom for the economy also.
Oh, absolutely.
Be lots of players coming in. If we bring in 4 teams, that's up to 60 players coming with mom and dad, some of them driving down, some of them taking the ferry, staying in hotels. So it's, having the rink here and having these types that it provides, these types of tournaments, really provides an extra benefit to the community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you can find out everything you need to know at the website. If you have a question, you could call Arnold at, what's that number again?
At 321-3505.
And we're talking about the youth hockey here in Juneau. It's Juneau Douglas Ice Association. And then if you two could come back before the Power Clinic, if it's not the Power Skate Clinic, if it's not filled, and by all means, come back for the tournaments, because both of them, the big one in March and the one in December.
Yes.
Because besides the hockey community, people might want to come out and look at it, come and participate. And then
that would
spread the love of hockey to even more people, just to come and say, hey, let's go check out this hockey game, just like we all go check out gold medal and the other sports activities, the football and so on and so forth.
So absolutely.
That would be great. All right, well, thank you so much for what you do. And wait, before you go, 160 kids, how many coaches?
I think we're up to about 25 coaches at this point.
That's
yeah, so
great.
The ratio, especially at the young ages, we have lots of coaches on the ice, as Steve was saying, for the real young players. And as it gets older, we get to 2, but there's always 2 or 3 coaches out there on the ice.
It's a great resource for a community our size to get the kids active and competent. It must be such a big skill builder besides just, playing hockey, which is really a lot of fun, I would imagine. But it's also probably a great skill builder.
It's a great skill builder, but it also builds a lot of character. It's for many kids, it's a place they can come, it's away from school, it's away from family. They get 1 hour on the ice. They build a lot of strong relationships with other friends. They become part of something bigger. They learn a lot of life skills through it. And it's a very disciplined sport.
No,
not just only in the sense you play, but also in how you act, and how you behave on the ice, and how you treat other players, how you win with dignity and how you lose games with dignity. So we try to really provide some long-lasting lessons, even for those that may not, they may not choose hockey after a few years. While they're there, we really make it a point that they learn some good skills.
They quickly become role models, too. They really do. And that's rewarding for me to watch. I know Arnold had said the same thing.
Watch kids grow into being role models.
They're going to be role models in so many ways.
Right.
At
because
school,
there's the safety issue, but then there's also the respect and the dignity of how you do it.
Absolutely.
So that's great. Well, thank you so much for what you do and coming in, and by all means, come by anytime to chat up what's going on at the ice, because that would be great. And it's 3:34. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 8th of October, 2014. It's the day that Christopher Columbus reached the New World, 1492 on this date. One of the sailors on the Pinta sighted land, an island in the Bahamas. They'd been at sea for 10 weeks from Palos, Spain, Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Niña. Columbus thought he had reached East Asia when he sighted Cuba. He thought it was China. When they landed on Hispaniola, he thought it might be Japan. He made 4 expeditions to the New World during his lifetime, and his discovery made Spain the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth. It's the birthday of John Cooper Powys, born in Derbyshire, England, 1872, novelist and poet, moved to upstate New York in 1930, wrote his masterpieces Weymouth Sands and his autobiography Glastonbury Romance. John Cooper Powys did not care for modern life so much, never drove a car, never used a typewriter, did not like talking on the telephone. Powys said, "A great modern novel consists of and ought to include just about everything." It was on this day, 1956, the Yankees pitcher Don Larsen pitched a perfect game in the World Series, faced 27 batters, not one made it to first base. It is still the only perfect World Series game in history, one of only 20 perfect games in baseball history. According to Larsen, he didn't even know he would be pitching until he got to the ballpark. He'd had a disastrous game in Game 2 against the Dodgers, lasted only 2 innings, allowed 4 runs on 4 walks. The Yankees had been up 6-0 when Larsen took the mound in Game 2, and they ended up losing 13-8. So he was astonished when he came to the ballpark for Game 5 to find that the manager had tucked a baseball in his spikes. It's the birthday of the poet and author Blake Morrison, born Skipton, North Yorkshire, England, 1950, author of the memoir And When Did You Last See Your Father? The birthday of the science fiction author Frank Herbert, Tacoma, Washington, 1920, best known for his masterpiece Dune, which was rejected by 20 publishers before it was finally brought out by Chilton, a publisher who had been best known for publishing auto repair manuals. It's the birthday of the historian of the sinking of the Titanic, Walter Lord, 1917, in Baltimore. The book was A Night to Remember. It was a bestseller when it came out in 1955. Here's a poem for today by Mark Strand entitled The Hill. I have come this far on my own legs, missing the bus, missing taxis, climbing always, 1 foot in front of the other. That is the way I do it. It does not bother me the way the hill goes on, grass beside the road, a tree rattling its black leaves, so what? The longer I walk, the farther I am from everything. 1 foot in front of the other, the hours pass. 1 foot in front of the other, the years pass. The colors of arrival fade. That is the way I do it. Mark Strand's poem, The Hill, from his collected poems, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for a Juno Afternoon comes from BEP Company, providing remanufacturing and recycling services for toner and inkjet print cartridges. Serving Juno for 25 years. More information at bepcompany.com or 789-2230.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon live from the KTOO studios here in Juno. It's 3:39 p.m. At the airport, it's 47. Downtown Juno is 46, and the valley is 46 as well. So next up, we're going to listen to Mark Chestnut. He's playing in town next Monday for a concert to benefit the Fraternal Order of Alaska State Troopers. Find out more, you can go to the KTOO community calendar, and here he is, Mark Chestnut.
Off down at Margie's bar, telling stories if we had one. Someone fired the old jukebox up, the song it sure was a sad one. Teardrop rolled down Bubba's nose, from the pain the song was inflicting. And all at once he jumped to his feet, just like somebody kicked him. Bubba shot the jukebox that night, said it played a sad song, it made him cry. Went to his truck and got a 45. Bubba shot the jukebox last night. Bubba ain't never been accused of being mentally stable, so we did not draw an easy breath till he laid that Colt on the table. He hung his head till the cops showed up. He dragged him right out of Margie's. They told him, don't you play dumb with us, son. You know damn well what the charge is. Bubba shot the jukebox last night. Said it played a sad song. It made him cry. Went to his truck and got a 45. But he shot the jukebox last night. Arrived with his bathrobe on, the confrontation was a tense one. He shook his head and said, Bubba, boy, you was always a dense one. A reckless discharge of a gun, that's what the officers are claiming. Bubba hollered out, reckless hell, I hit just where I was aiming. Bubba shot the jukebox last night, said it played a sad song, it made him cry. Went to his truck and got a 45. Well, he shot the jukebox, stopped with one shot. Bubba shot the jukebox last night. But he could not tell right from wrong through the teardrops in his eyes. Beyond the shadow of a doubt, it was a justifiable homicide.
That's Mark Chestnut. He's in Juneau next Monday to benefit having a concert to benefit the Fraternal Order of Alaska State Troopers. To find out how to get your tickets, you could go to the KTOO community calendar on ktoo.org. It is 3:43 p.m. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO News. And here in the studio is Fire Chief Ed Quinto. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
How are you, Chief Quinto, today?
Doing pretty good.
Okay.
Nice day.
It was. It's changing, but it was glorious this
it's
morning.
It's not raining.
Exactly. So you're here to chat about this 33rd Annual National Fallen Firefighters Memorial Weekend, and there's a candlelight vigil this Saturday, October 11th, at the downtown fire hall. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we've been holding it for a while. Of course, it's the 33rd annual nationally, but we've been holding our candlelight vigil last few years before we've had a full-blown ceremony, but we've kind of narrowed down this year, last few years. Anyway, we're going to have it at the Juneau Fire Station downtown across from the Federal Building, and we're going to start at 7 o'clock. And we'll have reading of the fallen firefighters' names, and which is about 107 of them have died since October 12, 2013.
Nationally.
And in the state of Alaska, since 1941, we'd had 24 fire deaths of firefighters. The last one was March 7th of this year of a fire captain in Anchorage. So we'll be reading all their names during that time, and then after the reading of the names, we'll give a brief description of the last alarm. The last alarm is basically ringing of the bell, which signifies the end of their tour at that day. So this is the last alarm for the individuals.
Kind of like the 21 gun salute.
Exactly.
A show of respect and gratitude.
Yes. And then, of course, we'll, I believe we have a cake that night. So.
Okay. All right. So that's this Saturday at 7 o'clock at the downtown fire hall across from the federal building.
Right. We're going to hold it outside if the weather's really nice. If it's not, we'll hold it inside.
There's plenty of room.
Yes, it is.
We've taken tours of that facility. Plenty of rooms. Okay. So speaking of firefighters, right now you have two programs going on. You're looking for some volunteers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. During this time of the year, we do an active volunteer firefighting recruitment. We're looking for adults to be firefighters. So they start out as scene support. Scene support firefighters basically do everything outside the fire. They run tools. They do ladders. They break windows. They run power tools. The only thing they can't do is go inside a real fire. In order to do that, they have to go through the Firefighter Academy, which is about 240 hours. They get qualified. We provide that kind of training for free. We're starting one in January. If anybody is interested to become an entry qualified firefighter, when they get done with this program, they become a certified firefighter. You can take the certification and go anywhere in the United States. So it's a very worthwhile academy. And they become true entry qualified firefighters. So we have lots of jobs for scene support. It frees up the other firefighters to go inside and fight the fires. But there's also a lot of support that's needed outside.
And so, what's the prerequisite for scene support? Like, if you're interested to be, oh yeah, you know, I'd like to do that.
You have to be at least 18. It's our minimum age requirement. You have to have a clean criminal record, clean driving record, and be able to have the willingness to train and support the community. So you have to go turn in your application. You can get the application online at juno.org/CCFR, or you can stop by our headquarters across from the federal building during normal business hours. We have the application, or you can stop by in the fire station and talk to the firefighters. You can apply that way, and it goes through a process. They get interviewed. They get their background check done. Then they come in, and then we provide the equipment and the training to be a scene support.
How much does that equipment weigh?
Oh, dry or wet? Normal day, it's wet.
Both?
Well, yes. Normally, they weigh about 50 pounds.
Wow.
Just for the fire gear, boots. The cost of the equipment that we give to a firefighter is about $2,500
per
firefighter. And, you know, we don't skimp on equipment because it's saving your life.
Absolutely
so
not.
You're in an environment 1,000, 2,000 degree Fahrenheit of fire, and we want to make sure you're going to be safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. So the scene support, they have to be able to wear 50 pounds worth of gear or move in 50 pounds worth of gear.
They should be in fairly pretty good condition. Be able to put on gear, be able to climb ladders. They have to be able to carry equipment and pull hose. So you have to be semi-physically fit to do this job. You can't be sitting on the couch all the time and suddenly become a firefighter. That doesn't happen. So you have to have some sort of physical fitness.
Okay. All right. And then you also have this cadet program, and this is for younger people.
Yes. We're reviving the cadet program that we had a long time ago. The cadet program is tailored for 16 to 18-year-olds. And basically what it is they're not scene support. They're not entry qualified. They're basically – they can do things that is allowable for 16 to 18-year-olds to be able to operate. They can't operate power tools, but there's so many things they can do. For instance, they can do scene protection. They can keep people away. They can help with hoses. They can carry the equipment to a certain area in the fire ground. They can't run it, but at least they can carry it. So they can do things that will free an adult firefighter to do more crucial tasks.
Okay. And there is an informational meeting October 9th. That's tomorrow.
Yes.
At 5:30 at the Auk Bay Fire Station. So this is for 16 to 18-year-olds. They must have a signed parental consent form. They must provide two references, and they also must maintain at least a C average in school. If you want more information, I guess the good number is 586-0259.
Yes. So that informational meeting will be, it's a good idea to bring the child and the parent. The parent's probably the one that's going to ask more questions than the child. We'll go over the program, the prerequisites, what we're going to be doing. We're going to talk about the academy that the kids will be coming through. And then we'll talk about after the academy, then they get to respond to certain calls. Not all, they can't go to every single call, but a good majority of them. A lot of it's going to be based on what will the parents allow the child to do. If they allow the child to respond to fires only, or maybe they can respond also to motor vehicle accidents. So they have, the parents are a vital part of this information.
For the cadet program.
Yes.
Okay, so we've got the cadet program. There's an informational meeting tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Auk Bay Station. There's now you're recruiting for volunteers, and
correct.
That's ongoing, and you could drop by the fire station across from the federal building downtown. And then there is the vigil, the candlelight vigil for the fallen firefighters. It's a national event. It's happening here in Juneau at, well, the Juneau event of this national event will happen this Saturday at 7 p.m. So I just have a few more questions for you. How many volunteers do you have?
We have about 60 right now, 60 volunteers, and we also have 33 career staff. But those career staff, only 9 of them are on duty in one day between two stations. So when you have a house fire, out of that 9, one of them is dedicated to the airport, so only 8 are available. So to run a fire with only 8 people is not enough. So that's where we rely on the volunteers to assist us and to do put the fire out or get other tasks done. So it takes about at least 20 or 30 people just to do a normal house fire.
And if you become a volunteer, I guess you get called, and if you're available, you go, and if
yes.
you don't, you...
It all depends on the individual and their employer and their schedule, of course. So volunteers, there's no set schedule. Like you said, they respond when they can. Yeah, I started out as a volunteer when I started in this department, and I started out in high school, actually, my senior year, and I was only able to respond after school. And then when I graduated from high school, I came to work at KTOO. And then from KTOO, the fire department snagged me, so here I am. And the fire department has been a real fulfilling job, and I wish that anybody that wants to do this kind of job or think about like the cadet, it's a good opportunity for them to learn the skills and be career ready to lead them in that path. And they can. We've got a lot of career firefighters right now that started out as young volunteers in this department. Now they're career.
That sounds great. Okay, so we've been chatting with Fire Chief Ed Quinto. Thank you so much for what you do for our community and coming in today. If you need any more information, you could go to juneau.org and then go to the fire department, or just actually go to the downtown location, which is right across from the federal building. Thanks again for all you do. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
I'm riding in your car. You turn on the radio. You're pulling me close. I just say no. I say I don't like it. But you know I'm a liar. 'Cause when we kiss, I Well, Romeo and Juliet.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. Now we're going to listen to Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Look to the sky tonight, and you'll see a full moon. The hunter's moon, or as the Cree Indians called it, the moon of falling leaves. It's almost time to stow the tools and put the garden to bed for the winter. When the trees finally lose their leaves, you can see where the oriole hung her pendulous nest. Tucked between a branch and a trunk of a tree sits the sturdy cup nest of an American robin. And that bulky heap of sticks high in a cottonwood tree? It might be where a pair of red-tailed hawks raised a family. Signs of birds are everywhere, though many are now quiet. It's a good time of year to prune trees, because you won't disturb nesting birds. They're done for the season. If you have a dead tree, you could leave it as a snag and provide homes for cavity nesters. And now is the best time to plant trees, so they can soak up the winter rains. Before you know it, the trees will leaf out again, and the cycle of life will begin anew. Master gardeners offer help in the garden. Maybe you can become a master gardener. Classes generally run winter to spring. Learn more at our website, birdnote.org.
Disability myth. People with mental illness are violent and unpredictable. Fact. The vast majority of people who experience mental health needs are no more violent than anyone else. Mental illness affects almost every family in the United States. October is Disability Awareness Month. Know the facts. Dispel the myths. This message brought to you by Juno Alliance for Mental Health and Southeast Alaska Independent Living.
KTOO will host a display of 30 quilts during October by the Gold Street Quilters and the Monday Night Sewing Circle. Members of the two groups make quilts every year for two charities, for children being adopted through the State Office of Children's Services and the Aware Shelter. The quilts will be displayed September 30th through October 27th. They are on view during KTOO business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
It is 3:58 p.m. in Juneau, Alaska's capital city. You've been listening to Juneau Afternoon live from the KTO studios in downtown Juneau. Tonight, increasing clouds, rain likely late, lows around 38, but maybe we'll be able to see that hunter moon. Light winds becoming east, 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, rain, highs around 50. Tomorrow night, not as cool, rain, heavy at times, temperature steady around 50. Friday, rain, temperature steady around 51. Friday night, rain, and Saturday through Sunday, rain. Hey, on Friday night in the mall, Hearthside Books is hosting another book signing, this time by Jeff Brown, who's published a book, Great Alaskan Maze and Puzzle Book. Check it out Friday from 5 to 7 at Hearthside. Tomorrow, Shona Strausser will be the host of Juneau Afternoon. She's got a full lineup of very interesting people, as always, ending with the local arts activity roundup. Thanks for listening. It's 3:59 p.m. All things considered, next.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276A.